Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Murphy. Today's episode features content from an educational program titled Timely Treatment for COVID-19. During this podcast, Dr. Lenora Saxinger from the University of Alberta and the Alberta COVID-19 Emergency Coordination Center in Edmonton, Canada, discusses evolving clinical data on currently recommended therapeutic agents for patients with COVID-19. For more information on Dr. Saxinger and for a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides specific to today's discussion, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Saxinger has to say about tailoring clinical management strategies for COVID-19.
Thank you very much for having me today. I think it's really important now that we're a year and a half into the pandemic and we have a lot more tools at our disposal that we really start looking at how do we get the best bang for our buck and how do we get the best outcomes for our patients. And so it does become very important to think strategically. And so when we think about how do we prevent bad outcomes in COVID-19, we have, you know, the virus wants to infect people. And our lines of defense are COVID-19 vaccination, which by far and away, I think offers the best bang for our buck in preventing infection. We can reduce risk of infection. And even with the new variants being slightly less prevented, I think, by the vaccines, they actually still have very blunted disease and the hospitalization protection remains very, very strong. And so that's really, you know, the first thing and making sure that we've maximized that. Of course, while we're rolling out vaccination and in places of the world where they don't yet have a lot of access, reducing exposure risk through public health interventions remains very important and protective behaviors remain important, even in people who've been vaccinated with the Delta variant. And then another thing that can happen is in extremely high risk groups, reducing risk before exposure through prophylaxis has been something that's been investigated with a variety of different agents with variable results. And then when we look at our individual who has acquired disease, they will have some risk of going on to hospitalization, and they'll also have risk of going on to requiring critical care support. And there's some opportunities in there also to impact things. And so from the point of view of post-exposure prophylaxis, a high-risk person with a high-risk exposure, there are now some evolving options that one might consider in those very specific instances that wouldn't usually be something that's very easily done broadly. And then early therapy. And so there's some studies ongoing about various agents that might be used when you've tested positive, but before there's significant illness. And we're going to talk about some of those data for monoclonal antibodies that are antiviral today. In therapy for severe disease, this has been subject to many, many trials, and most of them are really focusing on immunomodulation. And some of those agents are in use already. And so there's all these time points that we can look at. And in terms of the approach at the beginning, when we're looking at what groups of patients should we think about when we look at options like post-exposure prophylaxis and early therapy, we have to be able to identify the people at highest risk. We actually also have to be really mindful of health disparities and how those impact risk as well, and try not to exaggerate health disparities by how we deploy treatments. And so in that area, I think there's a lot of interest in how do we actually assess risk properly and equally across our population to target treatment, and then also applying our study results to the right populations. Then when we're looking at people who've been in hospital there from the hospital through critical care, additional therapy and when becomes important in early hospital stays. So it's quite clear from the data so far that dexamethasone really is for people who require oxygen and critical care, and the highest benefit is in those who require mechanical ventilation. Tocilizumab shows a 4-9% absolute mortality risk reduction in hospitalized patients by variously defined criteria. And really conceptually, I think of that agent and some similar agents as really trying to target people who are having progressive or early severe course in hospital. So that's a difficult window sometimes to find. And then now there's recent data using an antiviral monoclonal antibody, casirivimab and devimab, from the recovery trial in the UK, which suggested a 6% absolute mortality risk reduction in seronegative hospitalized patients. So people who were in hospital, therefore with some severity of disease, who did not yet have an antibody response to their infection. And so that one is kind of in the wings and not yet approved for that use. So the other concept I think that can be very important is looking at where people are in their infection to guide what kind of therapy they need. And so people are aware that very early in infection, people might have minimal symptoms, but there's very high viral replication. And then you can get into a stage that resembles a more standard pulmonary virologic illness with cough and fever and shortness of breath, and that a proportion of people go on to have really severe systemic inflammatory and immune responses that themselves cause a lot of damage. So earlier on in treatment, using an antiviral medication, whether that's an antiviral drug or an antiviral monoclonal antibody, would be expected to affect the course. By the time people have had, widespread viral replication in their lungs and, viremia, using an antiviral is probably too late, and you are really looking to do immunomodulation. So you can reduce transmission also with early therapies. You can reduce progression with kind of those mid-range therapies. And then when people are severely ill, you can try to reduce mortality with immunomodulatory therapies. And, different countries and groups have different severity gradings. The NIH one, I think, is very similar to most of them, where moderate illness, people have significant symptoms, they have reasonable oxygenation, they have changes on their imaging. And severe illness is when people are having trouble maintaining oxygenation with SATs less than 94 and, hypoxia, high respiratory rate. So those gradations, I think, are important because people can actually move fairly quickly through them as well. And that might require, reassessment over time. We're in a situation now where, your patient at risk may or may not be vaccinated. If the patient has been vaccinated, what do we expect right now with the Delta variant being dominant in basically most places with current transmission? The Pfizer vaccine, we know that you actually get still good, but slightly reduced protection against any infection with 88% vaccine efficacy against symptomatic infection. And still extremely high maintained efficacy against hospitalization, so 96% efficacy against hospitalization in vaccinated persons. And so although I think people have kind of gotten this sort of despairing nihilistic idea that vaccination does not help against Delta, I think we really have to support messaging that that second dose really locks in your protection is incredibly important. The other main vaccine used in a lot of places, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, has slightly less impressive stats against symptomatic infection at 67% after dose two. So kind of converts COVID to a cold. And the hospitalization protection remains very high with a vaccine efficacy of 92%. So when we just look at, sample data from various jurisdictions, the risk of hospitalization is 68 times higher and the risk of death is 58 times higher for unvaccinated versus vaccinated persons in California, and most states have similar stats. So when we look at the severity again, we have to try to decide how to use potentially constrained resources. I'm in a public healthcare system, and so that has its own kind of responsibilities. And really, when we don't have limitless resources, we do have to think about where do we get the most benefit. And so looking at early outpatient treatment and also treatment for people who have severe deteriorating COVID, it is very important to try to risk stratify people appropriately and fairly. And if you look at prediction model data, it's so many prediction models have been developed. A review of prediction models actually noted that a lot of these have a very high risk of bias. They're poorly reported. Some of them are not validated outside the setting they were derived in. And so you can't just pick up any old prediction model. You actually have to really look at them critically. And I think most of us kind of are aware of predictors of mortality among patients because we've seen it again and again. But it's useful sometimes to look at the magnitude of the risk. And I think this graph is excellent from the ISARIC study group in the UK because it really shows how age is probably the biggest risk in terms of magnitude. From even, above age 50, having a much higher weight of risk than all of those other comorbidities. And of course, once you start adding comorbidities to age, these are the patients we really, really worry about. And that's where you'd like to be able to stratify. And this is just to remind us in a different way that people might come in when they're just starting to get a more severe illness. And they also might be on a very sharp part of the curve. And so an admission assessment of risk of progression is something that might need to be revisited because people can change quite quickly. And those people who are deteriorating might actually be assessed for different therapy. Now, I did want to call out an example of a risk calculator that's online that actually has been highlighted as being methodologically sound, and it is at riskcalc.org. It wouldn't be something that's validated in multiple sites, but because it's well-constructed, it's something that I think people can look at to get a sense of how this might work. And if you put in patient parameters, it'll give you a hospitalization risk, and these parameters would be at the point of assessment. And for example, with the parameters in that example patient, we're saying that the predicted hospitalization risk would be 14.8%. And then if you start changing different variables, such as race as a proxy for a lot of other disparity type measures, it does actually increase that risk. And so that might be something that people can consider doing if they're trying to work between sites to figure out who should get what kind of treatment. But practically, in a lot of places, healthcare professionals pretty much can read who the high-risk patients are. And I think that another practical point is that the current authorizations for specific agents have like very specific criteria. And, you know, barring any other data, I think that sticking with the trial populations where the agent has been studied and the FDA criteria are reasonable guidance. So it's kind of something that might be an evolution. So a high risk for progression to severe COVID-19 list from the FDA EUA criteria for a lot of the monoclonals that we're going to be discussing today are basically older age, obesity, pregnancy, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, immunosuppressive disease, which is a pretty big umbrella. And I think, you know, that's something that we have to try to find out for people better. Cardiovascular disease, chronic lung, sickle cell, medically complex children, medical device-related technologic dependence. So again, just medically complicated cases. And those latter ones really are pertaining more to the younger age groups at high risk.
Now working through the approach to COVID-19 treatment. So let's review the IDSA recommendations for treatment with COVID-19. Of course, other jurisdictions might have other guidelines that you might follow depending where you are. But in broad strokes, they're quite similar in that the guidance recommends patients who are hospitalized with critical COVID-19 should receive dexamethasone. Then for patients who have severe disease, so not critical, still dexamethasone. And then patients who have progressive severe disease or likely favored for early critical COVID-19 with elevated markers of inflammation, tocilizumab and then steroids would be commonly recommended. For patients who are hospitalized with severe COVID-19 requiring oxygen, remdesivir is suggested in the IDSA guidelines. For ambulatory patients with mild to moderate COVID who are at high risk for severe disease, the monoclonal antiviral antibodies are recommended if you have an infrastructure in place to be able to give those. And then for patients who are hospitalized with severe disease, inflammation, who are not ventilated, there's a recommendation for baricitinib, or else patients who are hospitalized with severe disease but cannot receive corticosteroids. There is a recommendation for baricitinib and remdesivir or remdesivir. There are some other modalities that would be recommended in trials only, which probably will evolve with time. And currently, convalescent plasma is looking a little bit doubtful. Just to look at the overall IDSA recommendations, there's a lot of things under evaluation right now, and recruiting to trials should always be a priority to help inform our evolving evidence base. I would just point out that there's pretty strong recommendations here against hydroxychloroquine or combinations, against lopinavir, ritonavir, or against bamlanivimab monotherapy because of insufficient activity against variants of concern. And there's a suggestion against glucocorticoids in patients who do not have severe disease, convalescent plasma, or routine remdesivir in groups who have more severe critical illness. And famotidine and ivermectin are not recommended outside clinical trials presently. Looking at the NIH guidelines, the breakdown is very similar in that patients who are hospitalized but don't require oxygen, really, we just give them supportive care, essentially. The hospitalized requiring supplemental oxygen group would have an option of giving either remdesivir, where they're not requiring a lot of oxygen, And this, again, would be the idea of an antiviral earlier in illness might have a more significant effect. For patients who are having an increasing need for oxygen, that group dexamethasone with remdesivir would be recommended. And then dexamethasone alone always would be indicated in the setting of people needing supplemental oxygen. Not recommended if they don't. For patients who are having progressive disease where they need high flow oxygen or non-invasive ventilation, that is the place where one would consider also adding baricitinib or tocilizumab in the setting of systemic inflammation as well. Dexamethasone use in this group is also very important if it hasn't been done already, and some people would add remdesivir here. If they're hospitalized and require mechanical ventilation or ECMO, so very severe disease and extreme critical care support required, all of those patients should have received dexamethasone. And if it's early in their course, dexamethasone plus tocilizumab would be recommended. The World Health Organization has maintained some living guidance for the use of corticosteroids. And it basically breaks down the same way where patients with severe or critical COVID-19 should receive dexamethasone. The definition of severity is a little bit broader than we would use in that it's oxygenation less than 90% on room air. In some studies, it's been offered with oxygenation less than 92 to 94% on room air. Then for non-severe COVID-19, there was no signal of benefit and a potential harm signal. So we usually do not suggest giving corticosteroids to that group of patients unless they had another indication for corticosteroid use. Just a comment on the FDA approval for remdesivir. It is required that patients have their creatinine clearance measured and their prothrombin time and also liver biochemistry started before starting remdesivir. And the dosing is as follows for patients over 12 years old and over 40 kilograms. There's a loading dose followed by maintenance dosing. And 5 days of therapy would be recommended commonly in patients who are not on invasive mechanical ventilation or ECMO. For patients with critical disease, 10 days is recommended. Reminding you that remdesivir is contraindicated in patients with a history of clinically significant hypersensitivity reactions. So that would be a fairly rare occurrence, I would think. Most people wouldn't be going for round two necessarily. Not recommended for patients with EGFR less than 30 mL per minute. There have been hypersensitivity reactions that have occurred. These are reasonably rare, but patients should be monitored. And also transaminase elevations have occurred in healthy volunteers in patients with COVID-19. And there's a fairly broad range of safety with that, but the ALT should be monitored. Then there's another list, and I think that these are starting to filter themselves out a little bit. Azithromycin, doxycycline, data so far not very promising. Colchicine, there is a high number needed to treat. This was used in an outpatient trial. The result was borderline. This would need confirmation. Fluvoxamine has promising data, but it's fairly limited and needs confirmation prior to wide adoption, so enrolling in studies would be encouraged. Hydroxychloroquine, I think, is honestly done. A huge number of trials have shown no effectiveness. Inhaled budesonide has some early and promising data that does need confirmation, but might actually pan out as well. And then ivermectin, which is a source of much interest. So far, there have been no high-quality positive studies for ivermectin, but quite a number of lower-quality observational studies that have created a fair amount of interest. I think that as things evolve, the weight of evidence for ivermectin continues to be increasingly negative, that it does not work. And then there's, of course, a bunch of things that are new, and they have quite a range of mechanisms of action that look familiar to people who like antiviral drugs. And some of these are repurposed, some were developed against SARS-CoV and MERS and hepatitis C. And so most of these are in phase 2-3 trials. And so just stay tuned for new agents as time goes by. And again, ones that work against the virus would tend to be favored earlier in disease.
And so we are going to spend a little bit of time on the therapeutic management of non-hospitalized adults with COVID-19, because in a way, that's the area where we've seen the most evolution. And you know, as a practical practitioner, I think that this is where I'm seeing most of the questions coming. And that's where, frankly, our hospital and outpatient processes are grappling with what to do with these agents, because deploying them and operationalizing them is complicated, honestly. So if someone does not require a hospitalization or supplemental oxygen and you're seeing them, is it possible for you to access these medications? And what should you be thinking about accessing? So the EUA criteria for the anti-SARS-CoV monoclonal treatments are basically the same. So for the treatment of mild to moderate COVID-19 in adults and pediatric patients with a positive test, we're at high risk of progression to severe COVID-19, including hospitalization and death. And so you'll notice that that is all outpatient EUA. There is actually no EUA for inpatient treatment at this time. So I did want to find out what's going on. I'm kind of familiar with what's going on across Canada, but we'd like to do a poll. At your institution, is there infrastructure to deliver anti-SARS-CoV-2 MAVs to outpatients? I think it is important to talk about monoclonal antibodies and variants. And so what we're doing with the antiviral monoclonals is trying to give people a head start, give their immune system a head start to control viral replication early and either prevent disease if given before exposure or prevent severe disease by basically giving that leg up on the response and, you know, reduce the viral load more quickly, et cetera. Some variants have been shown to be resistant to natural post-infection antibodies. So convalescent antibodies from people infected in the first wave might not neutralize current variants, for example. In certain monoclonals, just by where they bind to the spike protein, they bind to areas that are subject to a lot of change, and that actually results in them being less effective against new variants as well. And so whenever we have an area that is changing quickly, whether it's a bacterial target or a viral spike protein target, you either try to find an area that doesn't change as much, or you try to use combinations. And that's basically what's being done right now with the monoclonals. And so some of the new monoclonals are targeting areas that are more conserved and are less likely to evolve in the variants. And other ones are trying to get around the problem by binding multiple sites by using different agents. So how well do these things work? And again, I'm just going to say, I think vaccination works the best, but barring that, these can be important for individual risk and possibly also for healthcare system strain risk, depending on how they're used. So the bamlanivimab and atezolizumab combination has actually been paused, but you know, the original data suggested an absolute risk reduction of 4.8 in the outcome of hospitalization or death. That converts to a relative risk reduction of 70% and a number needed to treat of 20. So if you treat 20 people, you'll prevent one hospital or death outcome. And the infusion-related adverse events for that combination is low at 1.1%. For the casirivimab-imdevimab combination, ultimately very similar data with an absolute risk reduction of 2.2%, a relative risk reduction also of 70%. And again, these are being done in different populations, which is why we see a bigger difference in the absolute risk reduction. And number needed to treat of 45.5, low infusion-related adverse events. And I think that I'm going to comment that, you know, in these trials, when people get the drugs is important. And these were highly efficient processes. So most of the patients enrolled in these trials only had symptoms for 3 days. Were the vast majority less than 5 days. So this is not a late treatment. And so to get the benefit, you have to have a really snappy process. And it also reduced the time to resolution of symptoms. And then the satravimab trial, which is, I think, still preprint, had, again, a similar absolute risk reduction, 6.2%, a relative risk reduction, 86%, number needed to treat of 16. This agent is interesting because it binds a conserved epitope across coronaviruses, so it's hoped that it'll be less likely to lose effectiveness against emerging variants. And again, all these people were treated very, very quickly. And then just because it's getting a lot of buzz lately, I will comment that the very useful recovery trial of hospitalized patients in the UK reported their casirivimab imdevimab arm in hospitalized patients and found that in patients who presented with moderately severe or severe, well, more moderately severe disease, who did not have an antibody response to their infection already at presentation, there was a significant reduction of mortality in that group. So the absolute risk reduction was 6% and the number needed to treat 17. Now that adds a whole new layer of complexity in terms of how can you test for antibody response in inpatients. So focusing again on the outpatients where there's EUAs that are in place, testing access is super important. Patients have to know that they need to be tested early in infection and that those results have to be available and then they have to be referred for a process to get the treatment. The risk stratification process to get the best benefit from these drugs is very, very important. So how do we identify and contact high-risk people who are eligible? How do we message this? How do we keep it as equitable as possible? And then the other thing is, you know, if health systems are seeing a lot of COVID cases, giving outpatient treatment to reduce the risk of severe infection in select people becomes a capacity problem. And so do you have healthcare infrastructure and staff who can see, you know, COVID positive patients and give them intravenous or subcutaneous medication? There's also some trials for IM monoclonals and be able to monitor them. So it's a one dose treatment, but it still requires infrastructure. It still requires capacity. And so, you know, here we've been talking about setting up a specific outpatient infusion center. Can this be done in a hospital medical outpatient setting? People have wondered if this can be done by paramedics and home-based care. But again, all of those places might get strained in another COVID surge. And so the EUA requires that this be used essentially properly. And I include this slide to show the timeline, because the timeline would be onset of symptoms, clinical visit and diagnostic test within 3 days of symptoms. You get the test turnaround within 2 days after the test and treat within 3 days after the positive test result. And so that's fairly ambitious, but doable if you have an appropriate setup. Treatment is really needed within 10 days of symptom onset. And if you look at the trials, most people were treated within 5 days for the results that they posted. And I think that's incredibly important when you're looking at feasibility. I think that the early use is by far and away the biggest message. That there are potentially other ways that we can administer the drug. And the hospitalized patient piece is in evolution for recommendations, but the data there is somewhat promising. So the other thing is that these do tend to look very, very safe. I mean, antibody products have been used for a lot of different diseases over time, and their profile is similar. They stay in the body for half-life is usually around 21 to 28 days. And so I won't go over this in detail, but I did want to point to a resource. There is a COVID-19 treatment playbook for monoclonals that kind of goes over what you would need to do to look into the feasibility of delivering these drugs at your site. And so I just think this is really, really a practical way to look through it, because you really can't just do it as an individual. You really need to do it as a system. Now, I want to turn to prophylaxis in high-risk exposed persons, because this is another area where there has just been an emergency use authorization for casirivimab and devimab. So it is meant to be used for post-exposure prophylaxis for adults and pediatric individuals. And the criteria here really are looking at people who are at extremely high risk of severe disease, so very vulnerable patients, who are either not vaccinated or not expected to have an immune response to complete vaccination. And so this would really be looking at people with severe immunocompromising conditions, like people with transplant, people with hematologic malignancies, people on rituximab, not necessarily people who are on, you know, methotrexate or something. And they've had an exposure that's important. So they've been exposed to someone who's infected and they've had close contact, or who they're in a setting that's very high risk of exposure, for example, nursing homes or prisons where we know there's a very high attack rate. And so those three pieces, so they're at high risk, they're vulnerable, and they're highly exposed, is a very small group, but an important group in terms of severe outcomes. I'll comment that, you know, this area is of interest. Immunoprophylaxis is being done for lots of infectious diseases. There was data from bamlanivimab in skilled nursing assisted living facilities, which was positive. But because of the variant of concern issue, that this has not been given an EUA or expanded. And then for citravimab, there is, I understand, a prophylaxis trial planned among uninfected immunocompromised adults. So again, people at high risk. And so we'll probably see some evolution of this. And this is really protecting the most vulnerable. The key for number one, of course, was that seropositive patients are the ones where it's probably too late to give them an antibody. Number two, recently infected patients with risk factors for severe disease. This is where you actually really want to target use for infected patients. And then unvaccinated high-risk patients with exposures is where you want to target antiviral monoclonals as well. So nicely done. So take-home points. Conceptually, treatment of COVID-19 can be broken into antiviral and immune modulating therapies, and you really want to use them at the right point for maximal benefit. Antiviral drugs, antiviral monoclonals earlier in disease, and if people have more severe infection, targeted to people who do not yet have their own antibodies is how that looks like it might evolve, with, you know, operational considerations there too. Antiviral medications and MABs really are something that, if we can test, highlight to people that they do need to be tested early to get the possibility of treatment, and especially maybe pre-warn patients at high risk, especially those who are not yet vaccinated, that getting early testing might offer them some possibility of treatment that might reduce their risk of severe disease, I think is some messaging that can happen if there's infrastructure to deliver that treatment. And then for those very, very high risk situations, passive immunization with monoclonals makes sense. It's basically like giving a more expensive vaccine that takes immediate effect and doesn't last as long for people who are at high risk, or for people who can't mount an immune response to the vaccination. And, you know, finally, this is all very complicated. I know that there's a lot of controversies right now about the use of these drugs, but when we're just trying to help our patients, we have to really look at what we can do, how we can deliver it, how we can deliver it fairly. And right now, the epidemic of severe disease, especially, is primarily in unvaccinated persons. And we are going to be seeing increasing burden on healthcare systems again. And so being very strategic, I think, is something that becomes increasingly important during this phase, hopefully for not too much longer. So I think that we can move to our question and answer session now.
Our first question is, how are you and others ensuring a fast testing turnaround for outpatients to ensure that early treatment? Any shared best practices or suggestions?
You know, that's it's an evolution where I am right now. I think we've had the best luck when we've had specific dedicated testing centers set up. A lot of places are moving to more distributed testing, but that actually does create some difficulties in terms of turnaround times becoming less quick, and also the capacity of the system. So we can have a very, very good turnaround time for testing center specimens, but as soon as the volume starts to increase a lot, we see the turnaround times start to lengthen. So it really is making sure that there is a well-defined place, that the lab capacity is resourced adequately, that the reporting capacity is resourced. And I think a big question for a lot of places is the positive result has to go to someone who is in a position of being able to risk stratify and get the patient assessed as to whether or not we should be trying to give them one of the agents for early treatment. And that piece to me is the one where there's a lot of question. I've seen some places have moved to making that the primary care doctor's responsibility or the referring doctor's responsibility, but it has to be crystal clear that someone is receiving a result and that there's a process to risk stratify the patient on that result. And so very challenging, and a lot of disparity issues might arise with the models that we come up with.
Okay, do we have any data for those who have not been vaccinated, how likely they are to accept an quote-unquote experimental monoclonal antibody? If the infrastructure is built, will this population accept these new immunomodulators?
I think that's a really interesting question. I've actually pondered that myself. I would observe that I'm not sure why, but maybe due to examples of high-profile people getting these drugs under emergency use authorization, that there appears to be less resistant to the use of treatment-related drugs. The other piece, I think, is that if people are hesitant regarding vaccines, and part of that might be that they don't consider themselves to be at high risk of infection or don't consider their infection to be a high risk to them, and they get infected, I think that, you know, there is a little bit more of a long-term tendency of people to seek healthcare when they're ill and accept treatments when they're ill versus before they're ill. And so that is going to be something that we'll see playing out probably over the next kind of short to medium term. My guess is that a significant proportion of unvaccinated people, especially those who are unvaccinated because of access issues, not necessarily strong misinformation issues, will probably be keen on treatment.
Okay, I'm going to group two kind of pediatric related questions that came in. The first is, can any of the monoclonals be used in children? And then the second is, do you recommend monoclonal antibodies in children with type 1 diabetes who are under 12?
You know, as an adult doc, I'm less familiar with PEDS data. I would say that at the moment, the EUAs are for 12 plus, and so you wouldn't really go outside that. I think that it becomes an important question for the very, very high risk children. And there is a gesture to that in the criteria where they, you know, talk about medically complex individuals in language. That kind of makes me think they're thinking about medically complex children. So I think that there needs to be data to support their use. Having said that, it's clear that, you know, in children, we actually have the most experience using passive immunization for things like RSV. And so I would expect the data to that to evolve, but I wouldn't really recommend use outside the EUA right now at all. I don't even know if you can, actually. There might be some possibility of, you know, special access procedures. I'm not sure.
Okay. Do monoclonal antibodies interfere with active immunization against COVID-19?
They would. If you've received a monoclonal, you would not be looking to administer a spike protein vaccine until we think that that has cleared the system. The half-life of monoclonal antibody therapies tends to be similar to the half-life of our own immune globulins in our system, with a difference, of course, that we don't have a mechanism like memory cells to make it again. So the therapies would decrease over time. You would probably look to offer active immunization well after the time you'd expect the monoclonal to have cleared.
Does the Delta variant have a delayed onset of symptoms compared to the initial COVID strain? If yes, how would that affect the treatment window for monoclonals after symptom onset?
That's an important question. I think that the data I'd seen mostly from the UK actually is that the onset is similar. The symptoms are similar enough that you can't really distinguish. There was some discussion about that early. And, you know, the majority of people who've been exposed to COVID actually manifest their symptoms at around 5 days after exposure. And then pretty much everyone develops their symptoms. If they're going to get symptomatic within the first 10 days after an exposure, then the window, really the time clock starts with development of symptoms. And I haven't seen anything about antibody kinetics that would worry me that there's a difference in terms of when you can get an antiviral medication to decrease the virus with respect to when you start symptoms. So people have to have a low threshold to get tested still. And, you know, essentially pre-stratifying people to highlight the need for early testing if you're a high-risk person, I think, is another approach that we could talk about to optimize use.
Okay, I'm trying to group questions by topic. So we've had several come in kind of about tocilizumab and baricitinib. So I'll just read a few and you can kind of group your comments. So can you talk about some alternatives to tocilizumab due to the global shortage? Have you been using agents like tocilizumab and baricitinib? If so, how are you managing shortages? And then which patients would benefit the most from baricitinib?
So for the class of strongly immune modulating drugs that are targeted towards people who are hospitalized with a deteriorating course or an early severe course, so that's how I class those agents. You know, the data to hand that we've been basing our recommendations on are for TOCI and ceralilumab, and the approvals vary between countries. But if we think about those as one intervention, they are in shorter supply. And I think that we have struggled a little bit with trying to make sure that institutions have a similar approach to risk stratification. So that it's not just anyone who comes into hospital, but people who are having, for example, on the ward, progressively increased oxygen demands, where you're concerned that you're going to be calling for ICU support. That's actually probably the best window to use those, and assessing that and making sure that your community practice has a common understanding of where to best use the drugs is important. Because if people come in and they're the person who's going to be destined to have, you know, a few days of oxygen support and do well, that's not the person you want to use your doses on, because we do have supply constraints. And I kind of hesitate to be too mixy-matchy with drugs like this, because I do think we have to look at the primary studies for them and the approvals for them, because they might have similar mechanisms of action, but they might actually have a different magnitude of effect or other differences in their use that can become important. So people anywhere have to look at what's available to them, what the data supports in the group it's been studied in. And then for all of these, like whether it's inpatient or outpatient, looking for the patient who you think will have the best benefit, because we really do have access issues to a lot of these agents, and using them inappropriately, I think, really benefits no one, essentially.
Okay, we've also had a couple of questions about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. So with the low cost of these drugs, why not try it in early early and mild moderate COVID, and then also a comment slash question. I'm in a retail pharmacy, and we're seeing a huge increase in ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, as well as dexamethasone. These are written from mostly Teladoc MDs. Are there data to support this cocktail?
Oh dear, no. So dexamethasone, there's actually a potential harm signal if used in patients who don't require oxygen, so that's dangerous. Likewise, hydroxychloroquine, there's been a huge number of studies, and when you meta-analyze them, there's a potential harm signal from hydroxychloroquine use. There's also been prophylaxis in early therapy trials, which are not positive. So I think that one should be put away, like without doubt. Ivermectin has been very social media promoted, but you know, increasing numbers of good studies suggest no benefit. I think that that's pretty much able to be put to bed too. There are potential harms with its use. And also people who actually need it starting to run into supply issues, like people with actual parasitic infections. And so if you look at, you know, the evidence-based guidelines that we have, and there's even some living evidence syntheses that you can access online. You can look at the most recent studies. And I would have wished that these would have helped more, but they don't. And I think that there is definitely some potential harm to their use in outpatients. So that's concerning, actually. That really is concerning.
And kind of an infrastructure question. So for inpatients who develop COVID-19, so they're admitted with an initial negative molecular test, they're hospitalized for another reason, but subsequently become positive, but don't have severe disease. What's the workflow for giving those kinds of patients monoclonals? In our system, outpatients are sent to an outpatient infusion center, but they say they really don't have a way to do that for inpatients.
That's interesting. I actually think that some of that might change if the recovery data changes the EUA for inpatient use, because then we develop an inpatient pharmacy related process. Theoretically, that would be a good population because you have a medically complex person who's already in hospital. You can easily assess their risk factors and you know they're early in disease. So I think that that would actually be a very good group to look at. I believe there actually might be some trials ongoing in that group. So specifically looking at hospitalized patients with nosocomial acquired infection. But from a process point of view, I think that that would get straightened out if the EUA was extended for, you know, the select inpatient use that would be data supported. Otherwise, I guess you'd have to go to your pharmacy leadership to talk about that scenario, because in a way it would be disadvantaging people who acquired infection in hospital versus people, even if they don't have like a relevant medical condition, versus people in the community. And I don't think that that seems like it should be a surmountable problem.
Okay, and just a couple more questions. I know we're close to time. Is there any discussion of at-home tests? Some companies have distributed these with quick results in your own home. Any insights there?
None of the trials have used like the lateral flow rapid testing for identification. Emerging data suggests that some of those kits perform well and some of them perform very, very terribly. And then you'd also be running into a situation of kind of reporting where if you might have anxious people interpreting tests, and I don't know how reliable that would always be. So at the moment, workflows have not included the use of lateral flow tests. I think that it would be potentially possible to use a clinic-administered, high-quality and validated lateral flow rapid test to help triage patients in some settings. But like I said, the studies have always used the kind of more conventional RT-PCR testing, but that would be something that could probably be piloted reasonably. But I would say that not an at-home administration, but a health professional administered reliable rapid flow test would be something that would be worth evaluating potentially, because then the timeliness becomes much less of a challenge.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Saxinger. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full educational program, Timely Treatment for COVID-19, on the Clinical Care Options website, click on the link in the show notes. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thanks, and have a great day.